Hey, welcome to First Ascent Podcast, a conversation about climbing. I'm Jay.
I'm Lee. You might think we'd have this dialed by now, but we're always refining the beta.
I think that's what keeps it exciting for me, because each episode still feels like a go-for-broke on-site attempt.
Join us regularly to see if we send it.
Hey, Lee.
Hey, Jay. How's it going?
It's going great. We have an awesome episode today, and we're doing a little intro here into our episode with Tom Bowker, the famed first ascensionist in central New Hampshire and the rest of the White Mountains.
Yeah, we're super excited about this one because Tom's the kind of undeniable godfather of the climbing scene in Waterville Valley. So
absolutely.
We are, you know, sort of enamored with his exploits in the Waterville area that's so beloved to us. And he's such a good conversationalist. So just a little backstory for the crew. We tried to do this remotely the way that we typically do, and we had some really insurmountable technical difficulties. And so Tom was just kind of like, I mean, I can come to you guys and just talk to you in person. So it's kind of a treat. We ended up doing this in person, which always is a nice vibe.
Yeah, three of us sitting around a table drinking coffee. It was almost like real authentic conversation.
Almost. Yeah.
And we had so much to talk about that we went through our allotted time and then we continued. So we have a continuation episode on Patreon that'll post today as well. So if you haven't already subscribed to Patreon, please consider doing so for $5, $7, or $10 a month. You support our podcast. And in this case, you will continue our conversation with Tom over there on Patreon.
And we appreciate you supporting us. But I mean, honestly, you can do it selfishly. Like, you don't have to do it for us. You could do it because you know that you're going to get more for yourself.
You're going to get a lot more content, a lot more Jay and Lee and Jay.
Yeah. I mean, and as a teaser with Tom, one of the things we did was I looked up a couple of the routes, the well-known routes that you all have probably done or heard about, and I asked him for stories. We kind of prodded him to give us more details about the drama and stuff around some of the classic ascents up at Rumney and elsewhere. So pretty fun stuff.
So I hope you enjoy this episode. We were really psyched about this conversation. And without further ado, here's Tom Bowker. We've got Tom Bowker here in the office, face to face. We're normally doing this virtually, but we have Tom in the office. We're making coffee, and he came in bearing a piton from the early days of Rumney. So, Tom, welcome, and what do you have here?
It's awesome to be here, you guys. That is a piton from the base of the ramp on Wendell's.
Which, for those of you who know your Rumney history, you know that was the first recorded rock climb at Rumney, so goes way back.
Yep, and because it was only 5'6", it was probably well-traveled, probably the most well-traveled route on the main cliff at the time, and so that's probably the most clipped, fixed piece of protection in Rumney before bolts. That piton probably saw more action than any other piece of metal
and it's
on the mountain.
Just to describe it, it's like a... It's an angle piton with a ring.
It's a soft metal piton with a ring, and it's obviously been beat to the point where it's been distorted and bent.
Yeah.
And it's all bent. It's all bent to shit, as we would say in technical terms.
It is a beautiful thing. You could use that again. It would hold a fall.
Well, so Tom, speaking of that, you are one of the most prolific new routers in this area. And we want to talk about that.
I don't think I am.
I think you are. Everywhere we go, there are routes that were initially put up by Tom Bowker.
Okay, well, I've been on the planet for a while. and I really, on average, I don't think I've done, on average, more than one new route a year.
Well, how many years have you been climbing that?
So I've been climbing like 40 years. Okay? But, you know, so yeah, that's part of it. It's just the amount of time. And I don't actually go like gunning for new routes necessarily. I like exploring an adventure. Yeah. And sometimes I'll find a cliff or you'll see something and you just go, oh, I just got to interact with that feature. Yeah. You know, and so many of the routes, because like everybody you've had on your shows. I listened to Warden Chris Smith, Scott Stevenson. You know, these guys were in another league. I was a bottom feeder compared to them.
From the conversations I've had with you, because we kind of started communicating around my development of
Dickey.
Roots at Dickey.
Yeah.
Where is that? Would you say it's the most concentrated area of your phase?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And we were kind of talking about just sort of the difference in the way that we go about putting up the roots. Mm-hmm. And for you, it was kind of like, you know, you wander up once in a while and just like you put up a root, almost like we talk about that whole soul climbing thing, right?
It was
kind of more of that. And I think Ward and myself and many of the other people who have put up a lot, you know, since you started your development, kind of are like psyched to produce things. You know, we're like, oh yeah, like oh, yeah. we want to do this and we want to do that, and it's like it's a little bit different of a drive.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Dickey, all that development, that really wasn't more than like a route per year.
Yeah,
it was just one of those places. Oh, let's go over there. And it was always a place where I could go to feed the rat,
yeah,
so to speak, in me.
So to feed the rat because it was off the beaten path, or
because the opportunities were there.
Yeah.
I didn't have to compete with power drills and just how prolific the roof development was becoming. And I know I've gotten some frack on MP for, you know, whining about some retro bolting and stuff like that. But my background, I got a late start in climbing, probably not until my mid-20s. And my background had always been hiking. My whole life, I've been brought up with, you know, take only pictures, leave only footprints, leave no trace, you know, all these environmental ethics. I started climbing at a time when climbing had made that transition from pitons to nuts and the clean climbing ethic. Based on that, just like one bolt violates all that ethos.
Yeah.
And so I've always struggled with that.
Yeah.
Every bolt I've placed, I've always felt like I'm doing something bad. You know, looking over my shoulders, anybody going to catch me doing
that? It's because hand drilling takes so long. With a power drill, you do it fast and then you forget about it. It's way quicker.
You know, I was always amazed that during the whole transition into sport climbing and the ethos seemed to be whether rat bolting was legitimate and this sort of thing. And I've done both. And I don't have a problem with that. But nobody ever discussed power tools and how did we get power tools into our wilderness experience. And the best part about climbing, there are no rules. It's what you want it to be for yourself. So I don't like power drills, but I've climbed your roots. I've climbed Chris's roots and Ward's roots. And I love climbing with these guys because you can't go out with them and have a bad day.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way it is. So for me, that's just how I approach.
So when you started climbing at Dickey, that was sort of when Rumney was, it would have been the 90s. And then, so Rumney was really being developed at that time. I mean, you were
I had been to Dickey earlier than that, but because actually my very first lead was a first ascent of the standard route at Dickey.
That's awesome.
And part of that was because I've been climbing with Brad White. And I love Brad. This guy is the epitome of adventure.
We have so much respect for Brad White.
Bradley J. White, who's
Bradley,
what I call our, the Baker River Valley is Bradley J. White.
Yeah.
So like adventurous.
For those listeners who don't know why we're being specific here, is there's a Brad White that's much more associated with North Conway and that side, and then there's Bradley, who you know well enough to call Brad, who's on this side of the mountain. So,
So we kind of like learned together. Like I was like, climbing at the pound. I had a Willens harness, some gold line rope was my first rope. And I remember Jimmy Dunn stopping by the pound, flying up on his motorcycle, looking at me, he goes, get some climbing shoes, because I was climbing in my hiking shoes. I didn't know, you know.
Yeah.
Lived close enough to get to the pound and play there. And one day, this guy, Brad White, drives up, looks at me, he goes, you want to go climbing? It's like, sure. And that's kind of how it all started.
Wow.
And Brad showed up with his rope that he had found, had a very neat, unique smell to it. And that's where the adventure started. So anyway, I mean, on our fourth attempt to get up Wendell's, Brad had that first section up to the Century Box dialed down to about like 40 minutes time.
Well, and you clipped that pin that you have on the table right now.
And so anyway, I just remember one day, just telling him, it's like, I don't care what we come to, I'm leading it. Because I just didn't want to be playing him anymore. Yeah.
So it's interesting. I think more than any guest we've spoken to yet, I just have so many threads that are coming off as you talk. I'm like, oh, but what about this? What about that? And so I'm going to dive into one, which is basically, I lie somewhere in between, you know, the sort of drill happy kind of like gym mindset of like, just, oh yeah, let's make this cliff outside into, you know, sort of the gym experience, and the pure, more pure leave no trace kind of thing, where I use a power drill, but I do have that feeling every time I put the drill to the wall that like it, there's something in me that's like, this is sacred. This is not,
I don't think that's not true. Something. Yeah, I've seen you just be like indiscriminate drilling.
Yeah. He's lying. So I definitely get that. Yeah. I'm curious how you reconcile sort of that mindset with the fact that you are credited with putting up the first true sport climb at Rumney, which became the epitome of modern sport climbing. So like, how'd that happen?
That's what happens when you're a wimpy climber. I mean, Scott Stevenson, Ted Hammond, these guys are bold. Yeah. They were bold climbers, better than I'll ever be, just in a different league. Since you had talked to these guys, I remember going back through some notes and doing a little research. I think it was 1988, there was a magazine called Mountain that Nick Yardley was corresponding in. And he was had the Rumney section, and everybody was getting accredited for what was done, and referred to peer pressure is being popular because of copious quantities of fixed protection.
Right. So just to fill in the blank. So Tom Bowker did the first ascent of peer pressure in 87 is what Mountain Project says. So the year prior and it being the first bolted sport route on the hillside.
So actually you want to talk about pressure, and this is self-induced. When I'm 71, peer pressure will be 40 years old. I'm going to try a repeat ascent.
Oh, wow.
That would you'll that, like it. That would be something.
So yeah. we could rename it Elder Pressure. Elder Pressure.
And I think it was actually Ted Hammond who named it peer pressure. It was that day when we're all there. It's like, because I didn't even want to get up on it again. You know, it's just trash when I'd come down.
Well, I heard a story that you didn't do it the first day, and then you had to come back first thing in the morning before.
I came back the next day. I got my friend Jay play hooky with me.
Yeah.
Because it was a work day.
Because otherwise, these other guys would have done it, right? Or
yeah, I mean, it wasn't in a mean way, but it was just kind of the way it was. You know, like you wouldn't want to red tag something because that would just be a neon sign. Oh, somebody, there's a first ascent to be done, you know? That's kind of how it was.
Yeah, well, you say that climbing doesn't have any rules. It's like there are sort of some social norms. Yeah,
totally.
But we adhere to those willingly. And like, if somebody wants to steal a route, they know where to find them if it's marked with a big flag.
And, you know, so like some of my routes, like the one you mentioned up to Dickey, Brain Cramp, that was years in the making. At the end of the balcony, there's a wrap station with chains.
Yeah.
And you can wrap down that wall. It's about 140 feet. And we had put those in, you know, years. And we go out there climbing. At the end of the day, oh, let's go throw a rope down the ocean, the big blank oceans. And did that like 3 years in a row. And before I finally... oh, I think this will actually connect together. And you got to understand, I mean, I wasn't climbing at that level, but all of a sudden I got something I need to aspire to.
Yeah.
And I was super psyched about it. It took me probably 3 days drilling to put the bolts in.
Yeah. Those
friggin' Petzl bolts required two for every hole because the cutting teeth would be so annihilated by the time you got that first thing first in there. Yeah. You had to take that off and switch to a good bolt.
After one of our recent discussions about the
self-drive
bolts, Scott Stevenson wanted to make sure that we got all the right information, so he actually called me, and he was like explaining to me how it all worked. And
I still don't fully understand.
Yeah. Do you have any kicking around?
No, I don't. But
in your car?
what it is it was a bolt that threaded onto a holder. And so you had to clean it out every now and then because there was no way for the chips to go anywhere. They'd all kind of go up into the hollow of the bolt.
Yeah.
And these thing had a bunch of teeth along the bottom. And you just tap, tap, turn, tap, tap.
On the bolt itself.
On the bolt itself. And you had to get it to precise depth because you'd have a plug that you put into the end of that expansion plug. And that was dependent because that would hit the bottom of the hole. And as you tap your bolt into depth, it would, you know, go up into the bolt and expand it.
Yeah, and we've seen those come out where the cone isn't very far into the shaft of the bolt too, because people didn't drill it deep enough, right? Like that.
Oh, I've seen some bad, real yeah. bad ones. But I mean, when you're wrap bolting, and that was a wrap bolted root,
you could spend as much time.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I spent, you know, 3 days over the course of like a week and a half just trying to make sure everything's perfect and yeah. everything like that.
Well, to your credit, I mean, I've replaced many of the ones you put in at Rumney.
In Rumney, yeah.
I've never found one that was loose or sketchy. They're, I mean, like,
I think they get an unnecessarily bad rap because there's the surface area is huge.
Are yeah. these the ones with the ring, too? Do some of them
have I had one with a ring that was on top of the blackjack boulder.
Yeah.
And maybe another one at the beginning of Social Outcast yeah. or something like that on yeah. Bonsai.
You yeah. placed that bolt, huh?
Yeah. yeah.
I've clipped that bolt so many times and thought, whoa. yeah.
And that one apparently was really hard to get out. I think yeah. I took that one out.
Okay.
And it was like...
Yeah. Like fairly recently. That survived for yeah. a long time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And all those ones at Dickey, yeah. I also use the silicone adhesive when I put the hanger on.
Yeah.
Why did you do the adhesive?
I thought it was good to help them last longer.
Yeah. Keep some water out of there.
Keep yeah. the water out of there and just, you know.
Well, I've had to scrape the adhesive off the rocks before I patch them. So it stayed. It definitely okay. stayed. Yeah.
So you mentioned that the leave no trace attitude that you started climbing with and were hiking with really influenced your climbing. And is that why you've focused on hand drilling over power drilling just generally? Because
totally.
These days, hand drilling is sort of a throwback. I mean, in places
it depends
where
power you go. I think they're still hand yeah. drilling in no. Yosemite, aren't they?
In places where power drilling is allowed, you know, almost 99.999% of the people yeah. who are putting bolts in would use power drills. But you're still hand drilling. So what yeah. is it about the hand drilling that keeps you coming back to it?
Well, it's a labor of love, anyway. You guys know, putting up roots, it's a labor of love. And it makes me think a lot more.
Yeah.
I'd be afraid with a power drill that I'd just screw something up. I mean, when I'm hand drilling, the effort required makes me, yeah, you want to make sure this is going to be perfect
yeah.
And everything like that.
I've never hand drilled a bolt before, and it must be meditative. Like, it must just be...
Oh, you get into a rhythm.
Yeah.
Once you get the hole started, it's a little easier. Sometimes it can be really exciting starting yeah. to get that hole in.
Are you doing it on lead a lot, or...?
I would love to talk about my route that I put up on the Captain.
Yes.
With Amy Colburn. God bless her. The Captain, the slab, immaculate, perfect granite.
That's up off the Kank, isn't it?
Yep.
Yep.
And it's really no longer an approach than... The other cliffs, Green's Cliffs and all that stuff out there, it just hasn't well traveled enough yet to make it easy. And so it's still a challenge, you know, a bit of a schwack to get in there. But I remember climbing with my friend Adam Patridge, and we did John Strand's route, putting in time, just an incredible pitch of climbing. And going back with Amy and doing a bunch of other, like John Garlow's routes, the Chinos guys doing yeah. some of their stuff. But the whole time, right in the middle, there's this beautiful slab. And I can see why they didn't touch it, because I knew how much work was going to be involved. You know, there didn't look like there'd be any natural gear whatsoever. So anyway, 4 pitches, 24 hand-drilled bolts. I am more proud of this route than any other thing. More proud of this route than I'm all my other routes collectively.
Wow. 4 pitches. That's a tall cliff.
2 pitches are like 110 feet, and then 2 short pitches are like 40 to 50 each. Crux pitch is probably like 10A. And there's a money pitch, this 110-foot pitch of 5.8 sustain. It is so good.
Wow.
And good,
you're
good
selling
rock.
It. You're selling it. I want to go do it.
It must be perfect rock up there.
It is immaculate. And that's yeah. the one thing I'll get to say. I remember listening to one of your broadcasts about how we got to keep the rock clean and get traffic on it and stuff like yeah. that. I think the majority of my routes that I've done, I've never needed to clean.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I didn't need to clean up on, you know, Captain. Dickey's usually pretty clean. Some of the stuff I did at Rumney.
Well, it's always such a gift when you walk up and it is like, you know, kind of ready made.
It's already in its birthday suit.
Because there's some. Yeah. I've done some like where you mostly just have to dust it down or whatever. But like, yeah, typically around here we're cleaning hard. Yeah.
Well, and ground up is less prevalent in our neck of the woods because things are so dirty. Generally.
Yes and no too, but I mean, you look at like John Sykes.
Yeah.
Oh my God, he put up some bold friggin' roots.
What do you think about that? Like, what do you think about the putting up bold roots in this day and age where because it's bold, like, it's cool that you climbed it, but maybe it's not available to others?
I don't think everybody has to climb everything. I think it's okay to have routes that you need to aspire to.
Mm-hmm. Aspire to, not just in a difficulty sense, but also in a boldness or
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, because this climb on the Captain, after I started it, I really had like second thoughts about, oh my God, what did you just get yourself into? partly because, I mean, I'm living in the Mount Washington Valley, and I know the legends that live in this valley. And here I am, I don't want to fuck this up. You know, I do not want to fuck this up. So this actually took place over like two seasons, just trying to jive schedules and weather and that sort of thing. And you can't be productive going in there in a day. It's just too much work to get in there.
Totally.
Get one bolt in and you're going back out. So we always had these weekend adventures. We'd go on overnight Friday and Saturday. So we'd have Saturday and Sunday to climb and do the work.
We started talking about doing that tactic with some of our farther out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the part about this is the panic attack each morning, because I stepped out of my comfort zone every time.
Yeah.
I climb up to the previous high point. Oh my fucking God, what's going to happen now? You know, and it's just like, where's this next bolt going to go?
Yeah.
You don't know anything. And so like every day was like stepping out of my comfort zone, and every day was coming back so endorphined up. It's just like, it was unbelievable. So it was really, it was like one of the best climbing experiences.
So you put it up ground up.
All ground up, no preview, no nothing.
And you're at you're at your previous high point, which is probably a bolt because that's what you lowered off of. And then you're like casting off into the unknown with like some sense of where a stance could be, where the next bolt could be. Take us through that. Take us through that mindset.
Once you're on the rock, or once I'm on the rock, the anxiety goes away. It's just like you got the sole sense of purpose. All right, I got tied into a rope, and worst thing is going to happen, we'll get a little road rash. But you're still getting scared, you know, you're still getting out there, but it's not a run out route.
Mm.
It's not a beginner's route, you know, if you're just getting into the grade.
Yeah.
But any of you guys, you have a blast. This climb is so much fun.
That's like something that, you know, I've climbed many of your slab routes, and like it's something that is a credit to you, is that you're never looking to like scare people, but you're also not given a bolt every body length, right? Like it's I find that your balance of the pucker factor and the comfort factor are like, it's perfect.
It's really thoughtful. It's clear that there's...
Oh, I mean, that's why it took so long doing brain cramp. It took days to figure out how this is going to work out. Which also brings up the... remember when the Ward and Chris were talking about Bonsai Crag?
Yeah.
And they talked about my peer pressure.
Yeah.
And then they went over and did Centerpiece. I did not do the first ascent of Centerpiece. Oh, that was Scott Stevenson.
Oh.
And I don't even know how I got credited for that. And those guys should have figured it out, because they had mentioned about how that was a little more run out. Yeah, you should have known I didn't do that. you know, I'm the wimpy climber. I like lots of, you know, to keep it sane.
Yeah, so Lee's updating.
Yeah, so anyway, I had...
the guidebook right now.
I had started up that rope solo. I think I got three or four bolts in going rope solo.
Okay.
And then just kind of walked away from it for a little bit. And Scott called me off one day. It's like, what are you doing with that thing? It's like, I don't know, just procrastinating. It's all yours. Have at it. And so he put the rest of the bolts in and sent it.
Oh, nice.
So
I'm currently working on the update of the Romney guidebook with Ward. And for those of you guys who cannot see, right when he mentioned this, I'm like, oh, I took out my little notepad on my phone. And I was making some notes to correct history. So
yeah.
What's the name of the route up at the Captain? What did you call it?
Heaven on Fire.
Nice.
Oh, good.
That was kind of like an offshoot of like, yeah, this will get done when hell freezes over. So, you know, you'll finish this when, you know, heaven catches fire. And in fact, we actually got up and it's like, yeah, heaven on fire.
I like that.
You know, so that's what that was.
Oh, man, that's a very ringing endorsement. Yeah. I'm sure all of our listeners will be like heading up to the Captain now.
Oh, beat a trail in. You know,
there'll be a line for it. Yeah. Speaking of routes with really good names, Journey to Lost World.
Yes, wanted to talk to you about that.
That
the most random, like, strange crack just hidden in the hills that nobody would ever know was there.
It's facing in a direction where you cannot see it unless you literally bump your head on.
Unless you are right there, and it's this splitter, laser cut splitter crack, incredible, but like How did you find it? How did you end up doing it?
Number one, I was laughing so much when you were posting up all about the Yellow Jacket boulders and all of that. Like 2 years going, like there's no mention of this crack. It's like,
you actually prompted me because I messaged you. And I was like, hey, Tom, because I was looking for boulders. And I'm like, do you remember any boulders? And you said, yes, I remember a big boulder on the way to Journey to Lost World.
Yep.
And I remember big boulders up in Smarts Brook.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, so I'll just walk up to Journey to the Lost World. And like I walked up to what was the Yellow Jacket boulder. And I never walked past it because I was like, this is the big boulder Tom was talking about. So, you helped me with that.
At that point, he was not looking for splitter cracks and cliffs. He was
like, why waste my time on a splitter crack?
This was just another day where my friend Jay, Lena, and I, and Jay's been a partner in crime and so many things, just tromping, we're off into the woods again, off our house, go see what's up on, Bald Knob. And we'd actually walk past that crack. And you don't see it until you turn. Whoa, look at that.
Yeah.
Bang.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like just perfect. It's one of the best cracks in New Hampshire.
You guys, I'm jealous of the crew that found the mill stream or the glacier pool or whatever that.
Mike Zarnowski and.
Yeah,
and one of Mike's proudest moments is you saying, "Oh, I never found that." To him.
Oh,
because you found everything, right?
Kudos to those guys for digging that up. Because I've been climbing decades ago with Bradley J. Wade on Cone Mountain, and that was just choss, when you're seconding up and you hear the comment, don't fall, this blade's not very good,
That sort of thing. That sounds like a Bradley. Bradley commands when you're out climbing.
I just didn't have, I don't even know how they found it.
Oh, man. That's a gem of a spot. Now that brings us like between Lost World. We've talked about Dickey and now the Glacial Park.
Yep.
So this is all in the Waterville area where you have explored, extensively.
Oh yeah.
How did Waterville find you?
Well, I've always been a hiker. The Welsh Dickey Loop. You can tell by the thousands of cars that'll park there on a busy weekend how popular that is. So I always knew it was there.
Yeah.
And had gotten into climbing and whatnot, and eventually just went back and found my way to the bottom. Let's take a look. And that's when I did my ascent of standard route with Brad. And that was funny because I think it was, we went back the next year and we found a piton and a bolt on the crux going through the slab. It was actually just kind of like a tad just to the right of where we went up. And I think it was Chuck Woodman maybe who had done it.
Sure.
But that's the standard route now. That's the way it always goes.
Yeah.
The way Brad and I, or the way I had done it, was went up, actually got up over the crux bulge and just saw that I had so far to go for a belay. Ended up climbing back down to the horizontal crack, setting up a belay, bringing Brad up, and then Brad went up through the crux bulge. But Chuck Woodman had come back and basically made up a much better standard route. And there are several routes up there that didn't have any gear that were done. One, my friend Alan Hunter, who was another good partner, did this run out climb, something about yellow stain in the pants or whatever. Pretty much started at the beginning of the standard route and just ended up at the top of the slab going left or whatever, but it was pretty much no gear. And I can remember Simo climbing after he'd already run out like 200 feet.
It's one of the challenges I went through when I was making the app, the Gunks app for Dickey was just that there isn't a trail of breadcrumbs. I mean, and every part of that slab is climbable, and it has been climbed on a ton. So I think it's just best sort of to be like, many other variations have been done, it's wide.
So anyway, I also wanted to convey the fact that, I was a beginner. That's how I got, my first lead was a new route. People that are climbing a low grade, don't think that you can't go out and do a new route.
Yeah.
Don't think that new routing requires certain ability or anything like that. Screw them. There's acres of slab up to Dickey in that middle grade range.
Well, it takes something unique though, because it takes the ability to look at things differently, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so easy to just follow the crowd to Romney. It probably was, even back, back at that time, it was easy to just go to Romney, go where everybody else is going. But to look at the environment and be like, no, we're going to go over here and make climbing happen over here where nobody else is. People don't have that perspective, especially not now.
When,
and so how did you, It was like an offshoot from hiking. Is that what like brought you into these other places?
The hiking, what I was looking for after I'd done all the 4,000 footers, you know, and done this trail, that trail. The second time around is never the same adventure. And all of a sudden, when I was exposed to climbing, it's like full on adventure. I got cliffs I can go to now, yeah. Different places you can go. And even if you're at the same cliff, like a different trail, it's a different route. I mean, yeah, so that it filled the adventure.
That's interesting. That's how I ended up in it as well. My dad would take us out on hiking trips, and one of the places we returned to over and over was the Welsh Sticky Loo. And so it was one of the first times where we kind of went, I wonder how you could get up that, because the cliff, it presents itself, you know, and looks approachable.
I mean, that adventure component, I think, it's going away in climbing. You know, with Mountain Project, with climbing videos, with Instagram,
with us,
with climbing media. I mean, there are a lot of climbers who never experience that type of adventure. And it's just right there. Like, you could just go out and grab it. And it's such a big part of climbing. It was for me, you know, it's always been for me. I love exploring in the wilderness, in the woods.
I can't wait to get up to that crag you guys developed up on Osceola.
That's one we got to that you never got to, I think. Yeah, it took like crawling on our hands and knees through like a half mile of Krumholz.
I can remember the Krumholz at that elevation has got to be just the nastiest stuff.
Heinous. But that was my only opportunity to do FAs of like moderate cracks. Like, because you guys did them all, you know, like, at the easy places to access. Yeah.
Well, you're a climber. If you see a crack that hasn't been done, you're not going to walk away from it.
It's your responsibility.
No, we didn't find Journey to Lost World. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you feel like climbing's changed? Do you feel like, is there some sadness there?
Climbing has changed a lot, but how I climb and the way I do it hasn't changed.
Well, like, what is that like? You know, I mean, are you cool with it or are you...
It is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, number one, I'm old. Old people have always been in the way of change and progress. So I'm very careful about, because I don't want to be that old person. Mm. But I do worry somewhat, what's the next generation who's still looking to make a name? Climbing always going to be, like sport climbing, just about difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the sport going to go? Big blank sections of rock like you see out in Moab, or even like the Mordor Wall, they going to become fair game to do?
Yeah, like, you know, manufacturing.
Yeah, or whatever. Because I've been of the opinion, you bolt holds on that Mordor Wall, 200-foot 5.5, and you're going to have a line at the bottom. I'm sorry.
Nobody's condoning this.
Yeah, I know, you know. But I mean, I think that's the reality of it, that people would... maybe raise a little bit of flack. Oh, that's, you know, that was a bad thing to do, but I'll bet you anything. There's a vertical 5.5 jug fest 200 feet up the Mordor Wall and all over it.
Which, you know, kind of presents the, you know, good reasoning for keeping the nature part connected to climbing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when the further we get from a natural experience, the, you know, possibility is there for people losing that, I don't know, sort of that natural governor as far as like not going too far. And what is too far to this generation isn't the same as as the past. So it's very interesting.
Well, and so many people get their starts in the climbing gym now.
Mm-hmm.
If you leave the climbing gym and go to Rumney, you go to Waimea, you go to Banzai now, it's not that, I mean, it's very different on some levels. Like, it's way better.
Yep.
But I mean, the environment is somewhat similar, related.
Equipment similar, yeah. I mean, like
The people are similar. The, you know, the techniques are similar.
The only good part is they haven't figured out a way to hang hammocks all over the gym,
or dogs all over the gym. And
I've seen that.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, Rumney's popularity is justified. It's some of the most beautiful, unique rock in the Northeast. You got to go to the Gunks, and that's not going to be sport climbing to find overhanging, you know, moderates.
Yeah, and you started that. So you're responsible for all of this.
Well, you know, it's funny too, because I can remember when I was first climbing there with Brad, you know, we were doing, you know, just tromping around the mountain doing stuff.
Yeah.
Most of the crew was just like, oh, weekends, you know, that's Cathedral Canyon, you know, we don't bother with Rumney. So Brad and I were actually climbing Rumney regularly on weekends before it was actually anybody else's destination.
No, would you say that because of your, you know, sort of bent towards wilderness experiences while you're climbing, as Romney became more popular, was that what kind of pushed you to go out to the world, like the wild places more, or like basically did it dissuade you from climbing at Romney?
Yeah, just because, like Dickie, even now, I can go there, I can walk along the base, and I can still fantasize, and I can still see lines. And Romney, it's not like that, because it's been so consumed, and I think it's consumed quickly. For me, the spirit adventure wasn't there, because I've always felt I had to compete. I don't like competing on that level, you know? And like Dickie, I could do at my own pace. For all I know, some of my first ascents at Dickie, maybe before I sent them, somebody else came along and sent them. I don't know, you know?
And but, you don't care, right?
Like, no, I don't. Like, if there was no guidebook, would I do anything different? If there was no recognition, would I do anything different? No.
Yeah.
I'd still do the exact same way I climb. And that's because it's weird, because Romney initially, oh, the ego thing is going to be a Webster's guidebook. You know, there was that, you know, oh, I'm going to get recognized for some of this. But then I went, oh, I don't need it. And I really didn't. I was really bummed when Dickie actually showed up in MP. I felt I had to do something there because the information, route names weren't right, information wasn't right.
That's the dichotomy, right? I mean, we want these places to be wild and we want them to be similar to your experience when you were first there. But we also don't want to lose the history. Mm-hmm. And like that's one of the things that's really hard, because if we're researching, like we were working on on the Waterville Valley guidebook, trying to get people to remember what they did and to give us information about you did this before this. And like, we don't want to lose that. But at the same time, you don't want to go too far in the information and take away all the adventure, right?
Yeah, I love climbing history.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I think that sport climbing comes up a little short on that. When you look at the book, you just see a name associated with a route, like Noodle up on Bonsai. You want to hear a story? The first ascent of that, Noodle actually started just to the left of where it's bolted now, and up that crappy little flake. It was called Noodle because I took a brass nut and kind of wedged it together with another little wired nut. It's got way high in the edge, and I got that sucker way up on the top of that little flake and did this high step into the edge. I mean, it's like kind of like A3X. Like, if this thing pops, you're going to hit the deck.
Wow. So you're aching.
And for the record, this is the guy who said he doesn't have any balls when it comes to
climbing. And that's where the Noodle came from, because my friend Kit Dover, who was I did that with, he called it because he said, just watching that wire just kind of wig around as I'm trying to get it in there.
That's great. I always wondered, like, that route does not say Noodle to me. Now I...
Oh, yeah. That's where the Noodle part came from. And I remember getting up high enough, I was able to sling a tree and get up in that niche and belay there.
Like,
and
under the upper roof, you belayed?
Yeah.
Like...
And then Kit went in, and there used to be a teetering block up in the apex of the corner. So that's where you put gear in there. And he ate it straight out the roof. And like partway out, all of a sudden it starts raining, right? And it's like pouring. And so it's coming down through the crack, and we're dealing with it. And it's like, you want to lower down and, you know, go someplace dry? He's there, no, no, no. And all of a sudden this lightning bolt comes out in the background. And it's like, okay, lower down. So we both lower down to the ground, wait for the storm to pass, jug back up the fixed ropes that we had left. I mean, it was like a big wall experience on this little 60-foot crack, you know? And so anyway, I ended up getting two bolts in rope solo going up to just to the right on that direct start and climbing with my friend Scott Ritzma. He just blew right past the next two bolts. I ended up retroing a third bolt in following him. This guy was so bold, one of the best on-site climbers I've ever seen. And I watched him go out that roof, trad. Spent like 45 minutes in this inverted roof working out the moves. One hung and went up over the lip. You know, it's just one of the most incredible sights I'd ever seen.
That's impressive.
And yeah, and I remember when he called me and said, oh, you mind if I put some bolts in that thing? It's like, nah, fucking go for it.
I wouldn't have known that so much drama occurred on that route.
I know. But I mean, that's where, you know, I love the history.
Yeah.
And sharing that with you just because that was like a big wall. It was just such an adventure.
The big wall.
A mini wall day.
Tell us about more routes, Tom.
Well, I mean, Journey to the Mushroom Planet. You remember I have pictures of Ted Hand. We used to aid out that and just fuck around doing stuff like that.
Were you involved in the Flying Hawaiian first ascent?
No. And I think Flying Hawaiian is the single prettiest feature in the whole mountainside. Yeah. That corner is the most coveted, beautiful thing on that mountain. But other things, I remember Direct Aid with Bradley White, Restless Native. That was done without bolts or anything on the first ascent. And or just with Direct Aid, you know?
Just gear, cams.
Maybe a pin or two, yeah.
Yeah. Did you belay Brad on that when he was doing it?
Yeah.
So in the, you know, kind of in the vein of the history discussion here, it seems like this impression I've had of you is correct, which is like, you don't want to drop a mass amount of people to these areas and have them become less of a wilderness experience, but you do have this desire to share. And so it's always in conflict when I talk to you. You're kind of like, oh, there's this really cool thing, and here's the story about it, and here's who did it, and this is why it's awesome. But I really hope that people don't go there. But I really want you to do it. You know, it's like you always seem torn like that. Does that
resonate? When I'm putting up roots on Dickey and stuff like that, I was telling people about it.
Yeah.
But would you say you have that sort of that battle in your head a little bit?
I don't know.
It's okay to say no.
First ascents are kind of a selfish thing, really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, climbing's kind of a selfish thing anyway.
Yeah.
But first ascents certainly are.
Well,
you know, we are the most privileged user group on our public lands.
You think so?
Skiers. Who else can make trails, scrub rock, cut down trees, drill holes? There is no user group in the White Mountains that are as privileged as we are.
I don't know. I think skiers could give us a run for our money. They do that, all that, except for the bolting.
And the scrubbing of lichen and trail building and all that.
Well, that's the thing is they, you know,
they're thinning out a renewable resource.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. They try to say they're not trail building, but the thing is, the funny thing is, this is the egotistical thing about climbers is like, we do these things, you know, kind of like surreptitiously and then go, we stamp our name on it and go, it was me!
Yeah.
You know, where like a lot of the other groups, mountain bikers and backcountry ski, you know, people who cut backcountry ski trails, like they keep it super tight-lipped. And,
oh,
like,
boy.
Only the in crowd knows.
Yeah, that's
true. We're like, it was me! I did it!
Well, I think it's ironically kind of an unselfish act sometimes because we're getting so many more climbers in this region than... especially post-COVID, right? Like we've seen an explosion of climbers in the White Mountains. And on some level, there's a responsibility to offer up more places to go because otherwise the original places will get overrun. You know, so like maybe it's just a rationalization that I'm, making for myself.
Yeah, right. The more places, but like, the more we offer, the more people are drawn to enjoying it. But like,
But I mean, like I just think of like, the Forest Garden and the Roadhouse and stuff.
Yeah.
Like we developed that. It's super popular. It's well bolted. And like, I don't care if I bolt like a well protected 5.7, like I could solo it if I wanted to, but it's not about me, right? It's about all the people who follow.
But I think more people need to feel empowered to put up new routes and that people shouldn't feel like it was had anything to do with climbing ability or anything like that. Mm. And I'm the perfect example, you know, I mean,
Do you think the prevalence of power drills, like when I started climbing, power drills were really hard to get.
Mm-hmm.
They were really expensive. Mm-hmm. And like it was, I got one.
Big and unwieldy. Yeah.
And now you can go to Lowe's and get a power drill for $150 plus batteries, you know? So do you think that's changed the development of routes? Like that there isn't that barrier to entry?
Because that's usually our pushback about the whole anybody should be allowed to put up a route is that not everybody has the understanding of where the bolts should go and how the, having that vision and stuff.
Yeah. And if somebody has the desire to do it, they'll figure that out. Have I placed bad bolts before?
No.
Probably.
Never.
Have I put up a crappy route before?
Never.
Yeah.
Did you do Friendship Tower?
Yeah, that's a crappy route. That was just
I was just asking a question, Tom.
It was what a waste of time that was.
Did you see that I rebolted it?
Yeah, I heard.
Is it still crappy?
I moved a few bolts around. I like it. Yeah, I like it a lot. Yeah. Tori says she wants to do it every time we go up there now. So
I climbed it the old way. It was a rock climb.
Yeah.
The only issue with that it wasn't the climbing. It was like the bolt placement was funky for free climbing. And I said, well, he probably did it ground up and was hanging on a hook or, you know, something.
Yeah, I don't think I did it ground up. Just a lousy bolting job.
Oh, yeah. Come on, Tom. Well, I shifted some bolts around and I didn't think you'd mind. And
not at all.
And I think it will be popular, especially now that that area has more roots.
More to do, yeah.
Well, and that's the same thing. It's like there are so many people in that area. That's a part of rock that it should, people should be climbing on that as well, right. So that they're not
it also,
on
it also
underdog
provides,
over and over and over again.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, there was like, there's the 5'6", a 5'7", and, you know, another 5'7", a 5'8". And then there was kind of a gap, and it's kind of like, okay, well, this 10 that nobody does because the bolting is funky, like, okay, move that, and now it's usable. So
I struggle with that concept where, like, if it's a popular cliff and one person does, like, a really bold lead on that popular cliff and, like, nobody follows it, like, is that just locked up for eternity then? I mean, it's
not,
a tough
not at
thing.
Rumney. It might be somewhere not, else. Yeah. All right, but Rumney is just—it's the red light district, and it's going to see bolts. It's
so it depends on where it is, right? Like, the lower left wall at Cathedral wouldn't be that same thing. But.
Because there's a trad route to the left of Friendship Tower. I'm blanking.
Happy Hooker, right? That Ted Hammond did. Yeah,
and that could be a good. A good sport route if, you know, I've looked at how it would be bolted and stuff, but I still am like, even though I live in the red light district, I'm still a little bit tentative about doing that or approaching people about.
You know, well, and the question is like, whose route is it, right? Like, so you put up a route and then is it your route? I mean, a lot of people have been like, oh, I did your route up at, you know, wherever. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, it's not my route. It's just a route that I just happened to climb first. You know, it's like the community's route, right? Yeah. Like, is it?
You know, what's really awkward is somebody comes up and, like, thanks me for putting up a climb.
Yeah.
Whoa, that's like, I don't even know how to respond to that because I didn't do it for you. I didn't do it for anybody else but me. Yeah. I only climb for me. I only put up new routes that I want to climb. You know what I mean? That's.
Well, I think that actually highlights a little bit of the difference that we were talking about, that mindset now. Like, Jay and I do put up routes for other people.
Right. Yeah, I'll never do that.
Yeah, and it's all good, right? But I'm just like, okay, so that really highlights that difference of mindset with development. Is like when we approach a crag, it's like, okay, we put up this 5'10 that we really wanted to do. But where's the warm-up for somebody who wants to aspire to that route? Okay, well, let's do this. Let's put up this 5'7 and this 5'8. And now we've got a crag in a direction, you know?
Well, you're a route developer.
Yep.
I've never been called a developer.
And what would you call yourself?
I'm just a climber.
Just a climber.
I'm just a climber.
Yeah, and I struggle with the term developer because I think it makes it seem like
I've seen you develop. You do struggle.
And, yeah. I took the wrong meaning for your smartassery at first. But anyway, yeah, I like to, you know, if I were to be like, try to be a little too highbrow, I like to open roots, you know, like that's like the.
Oh, that's kind of like the French thing,
the,
right?
Yeah, the European way of saying it. It's like, I would like to say, yes, I opened that route rather than I developed that route or I put up that route because, as Smitty has said to me about Underdog, well, I didn't put the holds there. I just put the bolts in.
Well, but then we've got the other end of the spectrum where there's editing, right, which we've talked about.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like, that's as far removed as from the slabs on Dickey Ledge, like, you know, the climbs that are being put up in Rifle and then in some of these limestone places that are like not good rock.
Yeah.
You know, so not, it's not just opening a route. It's, do I use the word creating a route? Like,
you do, yeah.
I think some of those cliffs, obviously, that have seen the sport climbing are choss piles that have been, you know, and they make for some great climbing.
Yeah.
Once they get all cleaned up and
choss
stuff.
Choss can be great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I think that's something that's been embraced. It used to be kind of like a, you know, a dirty secret, like that these were just like that Rifle in its natural state is kind of choss. And now people are kind of like, yeah, it is a choss pile and we have made a beautiful thing out of it. Yep. So, yeah.
Oh, you look at Shag's Crag. You been up there?
Yeah.
Incredible climbing. That was all covered in kitty litter. Every
was
hole.
It really?
Yeah, the whole thing is just,
I'm
yeah.
surprising
and that cleaned
the rock's
up incredibly.
So beautiful.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's surprising to picture it as choss.
Yeah, it was.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a new perspective we haven't heard.
Yeah. So what do you what are your goals in climbing? What are you looking toward?
Right now, I don't know, just exploring and to see if there's something that motivates me.
Well, one thing I've noticed about you is motivation is in high. there's a lot of it. Yeah. I was talking to you the other day, and I'm like, so what are you? How old are you?
68.
And you know, the other day I was texting with you, and I forget what the list of adventures was, but you were going to do a 3-sport day where you're going to go hiking and biking and skiing, and I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, living in Freiburg, I got the ski area down the road just closed, so that was no big deal to just go down there and hike up and ski down on some nice corn snow. And then, yeah, later in the day, I got Jockey Cap right in town. And I just bicycled over there.
That's great.
So it wasn't a real big bicycle day, multi-sport day. It was just a utility bicycle day.
Sure.
So I went from the Jockey Cap, then I went across the street after that to the brew pub. And
does that count as a sport too?
I bicycled there. So
there you go.
And then I bicycled home, you know.
That's cool. I mean, like, I know you're saying it's weird when people thank you for putting up a route. So I'm not going to thank you, but I will say you've been an inspiration to me, and I know to us.
Absolutely. And I'm going to make it weird and say thank you, Tom. Thank you for finding the routes that we've climbed, and for sort of paving the way. And we've learned so much, you know, in the Water Row region from what you've done.
I think that's too much. I don't deserve all those accolades at all.
Yeah, I think especially where we've been settled into the Waterville area and been doing a lot up there, and that is a place that's so near and dear to your heart, and you've welcomed us. That, again, like being...
Oh, it was so cool to see you do that corner of the Herc Route. I mean, I knew, you know, it's like I could have bolted that, but it's like I know my abilities. I'm not going to be able to get up that.
That's a kick.
Yeah, so I didn't want to do it, and it's like... Well, finally, somebody worthy came along and bolted it.
Yeah,
and that's like one of the most beautiful corners in the Lake Mountains.
I appreciate that. And I mean, that came directly from something that I had that you had done, which was that stapled Xeroxed guide to Dickey Ledge.
Oh, did I give you one or did you find one from somebody?
It was handed down to me somehow.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't from you. But yeah, in there it just said, the corner. Project, and it just said about the most beautiful corner in the White Mountains or something like that. And I
thought it was.
Oh, like, and somebody pointed it out to me the first time I went to Dickey, and then I looked at that book and I was just like, yeah, it got me thinking. And so, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, there was an anchor on top. I know you put that in there.
Oh, yeah.
And so, so you're, that's a huge thing is like bringing.
We dropped a rope down that a few times. That's why I knew that I shouldn't be the one bolting it.
Bringing the younger generation, the new generation up with you. And that's something I've been trying to make sure I monitor in myself is like, you know, we're on that borderline between being the young climbers and the elder climbers. And I'm already starting to be like, you know, all these kids with their jumpy climbs in the gym where they're like hippity hopping and like, and I've been trying to like check myself and be like, wait, like that could be the equivalent of say when Chris Sharma started, you know, dead pointing to things, and when somebody else started, you know, using nuts instead of pitons. Like, I guess I got to make sure I check myself and not be that guy. So,
well, and you're just you're a great role model in that regard. I mean, you could definitely be, you know, in the get off my lawn sort of attitude, but you're so supportive and it's just, it's so inspiring to see. So
it's turf. Sport climbing's helped me to be a better trail climber.
Yeah.
You know, and,
you're the father of sport climbing at Rumney.
So oh, I don't
you're gonna wear that badge.
There
forever.
Were so many other bolted routes that were put up even prior to peer pressure. And like I said, the magnet, copious quantities of fixed protection. That's how it defines sport climbing.
So we'll add Humble to his list of that. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Tom.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of First Ascent Podcast. We're really happy that you stopped by. You like what you've heard, you can rate and review us. Please rate us 5 stars.
At least 5 stars.
We don't want any lesser ratings. And you can find us on Instagram.
Our Instagram is First Ascent Pod. And we also have our own self-promoting Instagrams. Mine is xxleeweexx.
So extra. Mine's very basic. It's JAYKNOWER.
Real original.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
See you next time.